Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, I'm going to whisper some things to you now about Crunch chocolate bars. Because apparently this whispering thing is a thing that makes you feel things. It's saying something crunchy is coming in the candy wrapper language. Imagine your tongue hiking up those crispy, rocky ridges. Now, drum roll please.
Wow, that's good. Crunchy, munchy chocolate doesn't whisper.
Turn up the fun with Crunch.
Hello, I'm Kellyanne Taylor, and this is the Radio Times podcast. Every week, I sit down with a celebrity guest from the world of TV or film to talk about their lives, both on and off screen. To my fellow TV enthusiasts, I hope you enjoy listening. This week's guest is the actress Tamsin Gregg. She grew up in London in a household with her parents, two sisters, five lodgers, and a handful of cats. Her mother had been an amateur dramatics, and Tamsin absorbed by osmosis the yearning to perform at a young age. She graduated from the University of Birmingham with a first-class BA in drama and theatre, and then worked at the Family Planning Association before getting her foot in the door with her role as Debbie Aldridge in The Archers. Since then, she has had a glittering career on both the stage and on television. She has starred in some of Britain's most loved sitcoms, from Black Books to Green Wing, and most recently, Friday Night Dinner. In this episode, we discuss what it's like to juggle parenthood with working life, her love of trampolining, and playing a baddie in Paramount's new drama, Sexy Beast, based on the cult classic gangster film of the noughties. Tamsin Gregg, welcome to the Radio Times podcast.
And welcome to you also.
Thank you. I've never been welcomed on the show before, and that feels so very lovely and tender.
Yeah. I mean, you're welcome here too. You know, this is a shared space, and so you feel free to fill it.
Okay, so start me off with, what is the view from your sofa?
So I'm not sitting on my sofa at the moment, so I'm going to imagine it about what happens when I'm sitting there. It's quite a big sofa so that a number of people can sit on it next to one another, but without having to touch each other, because we have kind of familial space issues, and also annoyance levels are quite high in our family. I think they probably come from me. I think it's genetic. But like, if I can see somebody like fiddling with a finger, like, well, with something, with a pet or something, I'm constantly stopping them, because I obviously then I can't concentrate. So the sofa's quite big, and then opposite the sofa there's quite a big telly in the alcove, and above the telly the entire wall is taken up by DVDs, like a kind of art installation from the 90s. And on the other wall, the whole wall is taken up by CDs. So it's a very retro feel, because obviously we never play the CDs, and we every now and then play the DVDs. So really, it's just kind of like an art installation of, as our children probably think, just pure sadness.
I love that. I think children are very good at keeping parents very humble. When you do watch TV altogether, who gets control of the remote?
Well, it's generally not me, because everybody says this of my age. I'm not entirely sure what it's for. I mean, I know it does something, but I don't know how that happens. So someone else can have it and then be directed, obviously, by me. But We're generally quite, you know, if we do come together as a family, it takes quite a long time to work out the thing that we're going to watch. Because it has to be, there has to be equality and equity and compromise, and it takes hours and, you know, it's exhausting. So by the time we do get to start watching the thing that we've chosen, it's too late, and then I'm asleep halfway through. So I've got a reputation for falling asleep in movies, but which I think is unfair. But there we go, you know, that's family life, right?
Exactly. What do you enjoy watching on telly? Have you watched anything recently that really stuck?
Well, I do love a show. If I get into a show, then that becomes me and my husband's golden slice of the evening. We'll go, oh, do you want to do a whatever? And then we'll sneak away and do that, which is very lovely. And my dear mate, Sasha Bates, created this podcast called Shrink the Box, where she, as a psychotherapist, is in conversation with Ben Bailey-Smith, who's an actor, performer, writer, producer, does everything. And each week they put a different character from a different TV show on the psychiatrist's couch, and then they deconstruct them. And it's the most brilliant idea for a podcast. And so I've listened to all of those, but each week I go, oh, I won't listen to that because I don't know that show. But then I listen anyway, because it's so interesting. And then I go, oh, well, I've got to watch that now. So now I've got a massive list of shows that I've got to watch. But because of that show, Shrink the Box, Sasha's got me on to, like, the last thing we watched was The Bear, which has just been absolutely brilliant. The first episode I found a little bit like, I'm never going to get through this because this is too stressful. It's too intense. I feel really anxious. This is not like nice evening golden light telly. But I persisted, and I'm so glad I did, because now we've just come to the end and I'm so moved by that whole story and the, you know, Jamie Lee Curtis being brilliant. It's beautifully, beautifully performed. And my friend Sasha Bates said this beautiful thing on her podcast, that the kitchen represents his neurological system. And I thought that was such a brilliant idea, where the environment is a character in the show, but also represents his internal distress. And as soon as I'd heard that from her, I was just like, oh man, I'm on a different planet now with this. So yeah, we've really, really enjoyed that. My moments of like deep telly comfort, like for example, on New Year's Eve, I was getting a bit sick. You can probably hear the gunk in my nose. I've been sick, so I didn't go out on New Year's Eve. So I stayed in and watched Gone Fishing, Hogmanay, which is kind of like the culmination of that Bob Mortimer and Paul Whitehouse series, which is so full of beauty. It brings me to tears every single time I watch it. Then The Repair Shop, the Christmas episode, and then yes, a couple of episodes of Seinfeld. So that for me, and also if everyone had left them, I'd probably have watched a tiny bit of Gogglebox, but I wouldn't have told anybody about that, because that's my secret, like dipping crusty bread in salad cream moment, the thing you don't tell anybody that you do. So those are my, yeah, Gone Fishing, I think, is literally the best television I've ever watched in my entire life.
Is there a radio program that you enjoy?
Well, I love, as I've talked about Shrink the Box, I love podcasts. And so I'll more naturally navigate towards a podcast, especially if I'm walking the dog. And it also means that if I've got AirPods in, I'm less likely to be talked to. It sounds like I'm a very incomplete human being, that I go outside but I don't want to talk to anybody. But no, I do love a podcast, and I didn't really listen to podcasts, and then was suggested one which was called Dead Eyes, which is this absolutely brilliant podcast about an actor who was the only actor who was asked to leave the show Band of Brothers. And so he goes on this big trail to find out why he was sacked from it when so many other people kind of like launched their careers. That was a brilliant one. And so I now more will do a podcast than a radio show. But if obviously I'm driving in the car, I'll be Radio 4 until it all gets too much, because you can only take in so much heartache and disaster, and then I'll go to Radio 6.
That's very nice. I want to cast it back to your childhood. You were born in 1966 and grew up in Northwest London with your parents, two sisters, five lodgers, and some cats. That must have been an incredibly busy household. What was your childhood like?
Yeah, it was. You're right. It was quite a busy flat. We never had stairs. So when I got my first flat, which was a first floor flat, I was very excited to go upstairs, even though they weren't technically mine because it was a flat. But the flat that we lived in Kilburn was pretty grim, and it was at a long corridor with rooms off it. So there were five bedrooms and a sitting room and a really horrible kitchen and what my mum used to call scullery, because I think she thought that she was lady of the manor and therefore had staff and a scullery, when it's not true. You know, we lived in a shithole. And one side of the building got sun, and so they put in all their nice furniture, because they used to live abroad, and they came back, and then they put their nice furniture in that side of the house where there was the sitting room and their bedroom. And then the other side of the flat was the room that my sisters slept in, never got sunlight, and looked out onto a sort of part of the communal gardens that always got flooded because there was lots of drains there. So there was quite a lot of black mould and ice in the winter on the windows, which we had to scrape off. And then we had to go out and unblock the drain whenever it got filled up with food and people's hair. So I'm painting a beautiful picture, and there were 10 of us in this flat, and there was one loo. So wow. I did spend a lot of my childhood weeing, and sometimes don't tell anyone, pooing into a bucket out the back door because you just couldn't get into the loo. So yeah, happy times.
I always imagine, and I don't know if this is fair, actors to realise at quite a young age that they enjoy the arts and then putting on plays. And if you've got that many people, surely that's a great audience.
Well, you would think so. However, the lodgers were mostly students from the Far East or East Asia. So they were out, you know, working, and if they were at home, they were studying. So we didn't see much of them. And also there wasn't a kind of, you know, they weren't welcome into our family as such. You know, they were very much lodging in the flat. My dad was much older than my mum, so he became a sort of stay-at-home dad, which was very, very unusual at the time. My dad was born in 1905 and became a stay-at-home dad in his 60s when we were very little. And so mum was then going out to work. So it was a very odd setup. Well, of course, we didn't think it was odd. We just thought it was, that's our normal life. So people would say to me when I was out with him, oh, you're out with your granddad. And I'd be like, what are you talking about? Of course, it's not my granddad. This is my dad. Why don't you know that? So dad was at home. And so I did used to sort of make up stories, and if I got him to sit down, then I'd sort of perform them, and sometimes by candlelight, which was incredibly dangerous. But he always fell asleep because he was an old man. He was really tired, and it was in the afternoon. Who doesn't want to have a nap in the afternoon? I definitely do. So there was an audience of sorts, but they weren't particularly, you know, your typical matinee audience who just come in from the cold.
And when was it that idea of wanting to be an actress or an actor first enter your brain?
Well, my mum had done, when they lived abroad, mum got involved in the sort of expat community of amateur dramatics, which had quite a lot of status in those countries. So it was sort of semi-professional. So she'd always done that and really enjoyed that, but it had always been a hobby. So I'd sort of seen her old makeup bag and her scrapbook that she kept with the stuff that she did. So I knew that it was a thing that she had enjoyed. And she was a sort of performer in life anyway. She was born in Leeds and had an awful childhood in Leeds, but then left Leeds and then so left everything and became very, very grand, very posh. And so she was always sort of performing. And I think if you're around that, as a child, I think children sort of sense when things are not quite true. So I think the idea of performing, of sort of covering up, was, you know, by osmosis. And then I went at secondary school. I did a lot of plays at school and really, really enjoyed those. And sort of that was the thing that would get me through school to the end of the day if there was going to be rehearsals. Either that or trampolining club.
Two hobbies that go hand in hand. And don't know if this is an overshare, but I feel like trampolining always makes me need a wee.
Yeah, well, yeah, thanks for sharing that. I mean, it is an issue. And certainly now that I've had now that I've had three children, those days are done. You know, I've had to do a little goodbye ceremony to my trampoline. So I did love it. I did love that trampoline. That I suppose it's a little bit like that sense of flying, of being just airborne for a bit. And then, of course, I did a bit of parachuting when I was from when I was about 18. So I think that was always in there, that sense of just being sort of held in a different way. And sometimes I get that feeling when I'm doing theatre, where if there's a particularly wonderful moment that happens, you never know if they're going to happen or when they're going to happen. They happen at different times in the show, where everything goes very, very still and people sort of lean in. And that feel—it's got a similar sort of feel. I've never sort of voiced this before. It's got a similar kind of feel to it, that thing of being suspended in a completely new way that makes you see things differently and breathe differently.
Like a fearlessness as well, or an ability not to fear something that is quite unusual.
Yeah, to know that something should be frightening, but to step into it anyway, because something might happen that's wondrous.
Do you still get nervous on stage?
Oh, yeah, very, very much. I was just doing a thing at the Globe indoor space just at the weekend. It was a fundraiser for Refuge, the charity, this amazing play called Shakespeare's Women by Lorien Haynes. And it was where she collected all of Shakespeare's female characters and put them in a new play and imagined that they had all survived, but that they were all therefore survivors and part of an abuse survivors group. And each of the characters were Shakespeare characters. And so we rehearsed for 3 days and then did two performances on Sunday as this fundraiser, as I say. And, I'm reading from a script and someone is reading out the stage directions. I mean, literally nothing can go wrong. And it's so cold in the theatre, but I'm pouring sweat. I mean, so what is your body doing to say, mate, you really need to, there's a lot of danger here. You need to get out of here. And I'm pouring sweat. I'm freezing cold. I'm terrified that I literally won't be able to read the words that are in front of me because there are 350 people there. And yet there was, it was brilliant. It's a really interesting play. So, yeah, I don't think that's ever going to go away. And maybe it's necessary for performance, that maybe for all art, that, like you say, there is that sense of danger that needs to be leaned into.
Do you feel that on screen as well? Is there a nervousness there? Or is that just because there's not a live audience, it feels different?
Yeah, it's a different kind of fear, that because if you mess up, you can just do it again. I think the my fear is my terror of time wasting, that there are so many people on set, and if I'm not prepared, I'm not word ready, and I'm not character ready, and also because I get the giggles as well. I find the whole business quite ridiculous. And the only thing, actually, I've done that a couple of times, well, a lot on film sets, where I'll get the giggles and then, we're having to go again and again and again. And one time I saw this very wonderful DOP and I saw him just drop his head down, and the look of disappointment in his whole body totally cut through my giggles.
Oh, dear.
And it was a really interesting moment of you're just wasting people's time. They would just rather actually be at home with their families than listening to you wet yourself. It's pathetic. So then I stopped.
Sometimes you can't help it. And I think often when you know that you shouldn't, that makes it 10 times worse.
Oh, 10 times. And also if you're facing another giggler, Simon Bird, who's this brilliant actor who plays one of my sons in Friday Night Dinner, is a terrible, terrible giggler. And if I know that he's struggling, it's like going and stamping on a man with a broken leg. All I should do is not laugh and therefore help him. But I don't. I just go and make his injury much, much worse. And I just join in, and then we're lost. It's shameful. But also quite funny.
It's very funny. You spoke before about taking a break from theatre after having your children and also having a nanny on set for the first decade of their lives whilst you worked. I think it's really important that we have these conversations about working and parenthood. How did you juggle both? And they're doing lots of campaigns for having childcare on sets in America. Do you think that's something that would actually even the playing field or help working parents?
Yeah, I think they're very, very important conversations to be having. Back when I was doing most of my telly through the sort of late 90s and then through the 2000s, the way that I was able to do it was that I have an incredible husband who at the time was also an actor and just went, well, what do we do to make it possible for you to work? Because, you know, he wanted me to be able to carry on. I wanted him to be able to carry on. So we just thought, well, how can we do this together? When more work started sort of coming my way, sort of a bit of a snowball effect. And there's someone said, it was very interesting, when I was pregnant with my first child, I said, I'm really nervous, you know, how do we do this? How do I carry on working? And someone said, this beautiful thing said, a babies are born with a loaf of bread under their arms. And I tried to, I thought, what, he's going to be a baker? What are you trying to say? I don't, you know, is he a future Gales? What are you talking about? But what that means is that the baby comes provided for. And so it's then a matter of trust that, you know, the baby comes and you will have enough. You know, I often didn't trust that. But it was weird because the more babies I had, the more work I seemed to get. So, you know, maybe things go quiet because I stopped having children and I shouldn't have done that. No, I had to stop having children. But then, we also had this brilliant nanny who came to work with me. And looking back, it's really, really hard. And talking to other actors now who are having children and having to make those sorts of decisions, I think it is a better environment now where people are braver about saying, well, you know, if you want me, then you will need to provide for me and what I'm doing here, which is, you know, feeding another human being. I mean, it was possible for me to do it and have a nanny on set because I was number one on the call sheet. You know, I don't know that they would have done that for someone who was a day player, who was coming in and was number 25, you know what I mean? Which is awful because it should be provided for. Because if you want women in the workplace, because it's such a good idea, you know, we have to deal with the consequences of that. So, yes, I was looked after brilliantly by a wonderful husband and a great, very supportive agent and very supportive producers. You know, Verity Lambert, who was producing Love Soup when I did it, she was the one who had me contractually obliged to stop filming at 11 o'clock in the morning and 3 o'clock in the afternoon so that I could breastfeed, which it was unheard of back then. Of course, there are consequences to being a working parent. And, you know, then you only work that out when your children are grown. And, you know, that sort of removal from your child has an impact on both you and the child. But I do think that it's also very good for workplaces to see the reality of childcare and the shape that it takes now, because it is different. And, you know, we have to make space for the difference.
Spring is a time of renewal, so why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Free samples, free shipping, and our 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step and into your home, too. Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 45%. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Yeah, and I think that's so interesting what you said, and I hadn't really put that into perspective of if you have a body of work behind you and you're well known and you've established yourself in your career, you have different I guess, hold or sway over what happens. And you see that more and more as women establish themselves, especially women, establish themselves in their careers, their ability to say, no, I don't want to do that in regards to a number of things, or I want a more interesting character, or I want this or that. But it's actually, like you say, it's the people that are emerging or the people who are playing slightly smaller characters that are as essential to the script that maybe don't have those rights or ability to have that conversation.
Yeah. And, you know, along the way, I've had people, other actors, female actors, asking me, you know, saying, look, I'm pregnant. Should I just not tell them? Because they don't want to lose the job. Because there was a time when people, when it was okay for them to say, oh, if you're pregnant, well, we'll need to recast you because it's not going to work out for us. And I would always, you know, sort of gently encourage people to just be honest with it. Because if people don't know that you're carrying a child, you know, it's such a difficult and momentous thing to be doing, to be growing a child. It takes so much of you, you know, so everybody needs to know about that, not to be sort of hypersensitive and, you know, to let you lie down every 7 minutes, but, you know, just to have that consciousness of something extraordinary is going on in this body. And if you want that person to be a working person, then, you know, we have to really celebrate and honour that and, you know, not hide it away and pretend that everything's fine. We'll just, you know, we'll sort it out. You know, let's sort it out together.
In the early noughties, you play Fran in Black Books and Dr. Caroline in Green Wing. And it felt very much a golden era for British sitcoms. What was that like to be a part of?
Well, weirdly, like with many things in your life, you don't know you're a part of something until, you know, you're 10 years out of it. You know, like when you're rowing in a boat, you don't know where you're going. You're just seeing things that have floated away from you, past you. And at the time, it's interesting we talk about Black Books and in our conversation about pregnancy, because I got Black Books when I had just found out that I was pregnant with my second child. And so I went to the second audition and just thought, what is the point in being here? Because as soon as they find out that I'm pregnant, I'm not going to be offered this. So I sat in the interview going, I'm not going to tell them. Cause I'll just enjoy the interview. I'll just enjoy the audition. And then at the end of it, they said, well, we'd like to offer it to you. And I was so shocked because I was then suddenly in that point of like, well, what do you do? What do I say now? And I said, okay, I have to be honest now. I have to come clean and I am actually pregnant. So, you know, if you want to offer it to somebody else, I totally get that. And there was this terrible silence in the room. And then they all just said, no, we want you to do it. And then they worked it out. And so the scenes where I was in had to be in a sort of a tight dress, we did early on in it. And that's why I wear a lot of big shirts and ties and things and scarves, because I'm covering up this increasing bump. So I was really just trying to not be completely mad in a show that I didn't really know what I was doing. I didn't quite know what the character was doing. And also I was pregnant. So, you know, there's a level of weirdness going on there anyway. But apparently Dylan and Bill, who were in the show with me, both said later that they didn't know what they were doing. And because I was like what they called a proper actor, they just were watching me. Whereas I thought, well, they're proper stand-ups. They know about comedy. So I was just watching them and just copying them. So we were all just sort of like copying each other and hoping for the best. And then of course, then it did work. And so actually what I take from that is just copy the best person in the room, which is what I've done really with my career.
I love that. When you play a character, for example, Dr. Caroline in Green Wing, and you put on a character's hat and see inside their world, does it make you feel more empathetic for what those people do in real life? I know obviously it's a comedy, but, you know, given what's happening at the moment with junior doctor strikes, does it feel when you've kind of gone into that world that you perhaps align with those people more?
The thing that I found really amazing about that show, which we didn't know what we were making at the time. So all the brilliant editing on that, which came from Victoria Pyle and the team, where they, you know, it gets sped up and then slowed down, and the music is very, very integral. You know, we didn't know that's what was going to happen. And so when they would say, well, just like walk down that corridor, I was like, this is going to be a really boring show, because that takes quite a long time to walk down that corridor, not knowing, of course, they were going to speed it up and put music to it and it would be hilarious and beautiful. So I was in a sort of state of confusion a lot of the time doing the show, but also the sort of embarrassment of being in a real hospital with real sick people around us a lot of the time. And so I wasn't able quite so much to investigate their world as sort of be slightly ashamed that we were getting in the way, really, of them doing the good work. But however, since the show has been out, the number of people who work in the NHS who've said to me, oh my goodness, that show, and I say, hey, and I'm really sorry, you know, we're not mocking what you do, and they say, no, you're not mocking what we do, it's exactly like that. And I, which also I find quite frightening, because if the NHS is really like Green Wing, then wow, that is terrifying, because all sorts of terrible things happen in that show.
I think there's a lot that goes on.
There's a lot that goes on in those sorts of, in those wards and those buildings. And I mean, and also it's about survival. Comedy so much of the time is about how we find the joy and the hilarity and the ridiculousness of life in order to survive. And we did actually go on a picket line. The whole Green Wing cast got together, not this time when the doctors were and junior doctors were striking, but back in the day, I think sort of like 2013, I think it was. Was that when the last one was? And so then suddenly standing with junior doctors on the picket lines. And, you know, we were dressed up in scrubs, in green scrubs, thinking, it's ridiculous. Who do we think we are? But actually, standing with them and seeing the reality of the politics of what they do, you know, it's not just about doing the job. They've also got to fight to be properly remunerated for what they do. And that, I mean, that's exhausting, isn't it? Well, it seems like everybody's having to do that now, right? It's exhausting to say, yeah, well, I'm doing quite a good job here, so maybe you should like sort of pay me well or do good working conditions. I mean, why are we having to do that? Isn't that like, shouldn't we be seeing that? Going, well, that, you're doing a great job. You know what? I think I want to pay you more for that.
Yeah. just enough for what we're doing, you know?
Yeah, enough. Absolutely.
Enough. Your role in episodes took you to America, and I wondered if you were ever interested in doing more work across the pond and if it felt very different to making British TV.
Well, the wonderful secret about episodes is that it was made by a British production company, Hattrick, and therefore made in London. So I didn't actually have to go there. So that was perfect. So I could actually stay at home. It was filmed in London. And then each series, we went there for a few weeks just to film all the outdoor scenes of the hiking scenes and scenes on the beach and stuff. And in fact, the first series, we didn't go to LA at all. So it was all wraparound green screen. It was miraculous. So it was like a heaven sent job, because I could be on a American show, even though it was a British American collaboration. It was a co-production, but I didn't have to go and live there because I didn't want to be away from, I've never wanted to be away from the children. And so, and I've always set like a kind of 3 week thing. The longest time that I've ever been away from them is 3 weeks. And then I'll, you know, have to check in and see them again. They probably didn't want it, but I did. So yeah, it was, I couldn't have dreamt it up, and it came my way, and I'm, you know, eternally grateful.
Another thing that seems to have emerged over recent years is this real consciousness about who we should be casting to play what roles. I mean, we saw there was recently quite a big debate about who should be playing LGBTQ+ characters, for instance. And we've also seen backlash for Anthony Hopkins playing the lead role in One Life, even though Sir Nicholas Winton's family wanted him to play the role. And I think it's really interesting, because I think it mirrors perhaps change also happening more generally in society, where we're thinking about repercussions of our actions or having wider, more open conversations. What do you think about those conversations that are happening about actors being cast in different roles? And do you think there should be restrictions?
I think what it speaks about into really is, like you say, that the consciousness that we are making decisions now about casting, which are slightly wider about the implications of how groups who are being represented or depicted might feel about a certain person playing it. You know, I think the fact that we are, our eyes are being opened now, and often by this, you know, these new generations coming through, the ones who are looking at it going, what? You, hold on, you did it like that. Why did you do it like that? Or what? You know, I think those are really valuable views and perspectives to take on board. I think it's just really about being very, very wise and very, very discerning about each project, about each person that's being depicted, and to have the conversation open about, yes, who is the best person to play this, but also who is the best person to play this at this time. You know, I was very nervous when they first cast Friday Night Dinner, and I went to Robert Popper, who I knew, who wrote it, who is a Jewish man and was writing a story about his family, his culturally Jewish family. And I said, you know, I have Jewish ancestors, but I don't call myself Jewish. And, you know, I'm nervous about I don't want to ever be seen to be creating a stereotype or falling into any kind of stereotypical groove that means that you're then not going to connect with the truth of the characters. And he said, listen, don't worry, I'm not worried about that. I'm Jewish, I know what I'm writing, I see what I'm seeing, don't worry about that. Now, I think that, so that was back in 2009. If he was making the show now, of course we would have very, very different conversations. So I think it's just really about being alive to the conversations that are happening now, and to always be asking ourselves, is this right for now? And I think that that's only a good thing, right?
Absolutely. And I think it is really interesting because I think a lot of the stuff, you know, that I grew up watching, Sex and the City, Friends, some of that stuff doesn't land anymore. And you do think, is it right just to cancel it completely? Question mark. I don't think so. I think it is about seeing it within the time frame that it was created.
Yeah, I think whitewashing history is problematic because it's not being honest about who we've been. And, you know, like I said earlier on, you know, people are more perceptive than you realize, and that if there is something being missed out, I think somewhere we know it and then are just left with that sense of being hoodwinked. And also I think there's an element of us not allowing ourselves to grow up into new perspectives. If we say, well, that didn't happen, if I say to myself that didn't happen, in a way I'm infantilizing myself, because I'm not allowing the grown-up part of myself to go, yeah, that did happen, what am I going to do about that? How am I going to live with that? Which I think is the process of growing up, you know, of growing into that level of self-understanding and self-forgiveness and then transformation. So, yeah, I think it's very delicate and complicated and needs more air than often we allow it.
Absolutely. Look, I want to come on to speak about your latest role in Paramount Plus prequel to Sexy Beast, the 2000 crime film, which I watched the original having never seen it before and was so pleasantly surprised at how much I enjoyed it. When did you watch the original and how did you find it?
Well, I'm really glad that you've watched it. I think it sort of it does stand up. It's amazing. I watched it when it first came out. So, you know, given that I was having children and also working and therefore, you know, a bit. But so I don't think I took it all in. But I, you know, and I've watched it since then. But I think as a piece of art, it's really intriguing. I think the performances are brilliant. I love the language in it. I love the
insane.
Yeah, The language of the cinematography, I think, is really brilliant. You know, you realise at one point that the camera is attached to the massive boulder that's rolling down the hill that's about to smash into the back of Ray Winston's head and then is at the bottom of a swimming pool. You know, it's the cinematic language is really intriguing. And I think matches the robustness and the muscularity of the spoken language in it. So I was really thrilled when the script came through because I knew the film. So I knew its context. So I knew who these characters were. But of course, the character that they wanted me to look at is an invented one. You know, she doesn't exist in the film.
Yeah, it really surprised me, and please don't take this in the wrong way, but having heard you do interviews, you have the loveliest speaking voice, so soft, and I feel you instantly make people trust you. And then seeing you in this was spine-chilling because you are awful. Cecilia is a horrible, horrible woman.
Have you watched any of the episodes of the new show?
I've seen the first one. So I see you when you're speaking to Don and you're speaking to him in the gambling arcade and there's this look on your face of pure disgust. And having seen the original and seeing Don as this very chaotic, quite troubled human being and the way that he speaks and language makes you think that perhaps he's something mentally is eating away inside. And then seeing him in this, the prequel, where he is, he's not as damaged, maybe. You see, and the relationship with Cecilia, that evil and how it forms him and how perhaps it's a look at the people that do bad things in our society, if that comes from their subjection to other hurt, and she's hurt too, and that's why she behaves like that.
Oh, it's so brilliant. I'm so glad to get your feedback on that. So yeah, thank you for, you know, watching it with such an open heart. That's amazing. I think that's what I was so excited by, because casting directors can be generally often, because they are forced to be, you know, quite prescriptive. They're told in the script what sort of person they want. They get those sorts of people in, and then it's, you know, it's all quite straightforward. However, here's a secret: the casting director who cast Green Wing cast Sexy Beast, and I've known Rachel. Rachel Freck and I were actually at. Did the same course at, no, we weren't the same course, but we were at university together. So she's known me since I was, you know, a late teenager. And so was she. And so she knew that this character had to be somebody who could play somebody, it was somebody who was really terrifying, but like you say, really damaged, but was not going to live from that damaged place, was, you know, absolutely a survivor, but could also play the dark humour of her. And so Rachel has, you know, seen that sort of, those elements in my work and thought, oh no, she could do that. And then I think the American team on it had seen my work on episodes, and so they knew that I could... you know, I could tell a tale. And so it all came together in that way, which I was so thrilled about, because it's very unusual for, you know, really what we should be saying is, if we're going on from our conversation about which actors should play which roles, is that it should definitely be only people who live in London East 14 who should be in this show. Actually, the reality is, I think I'm probably the closest, having grown up in Kilburn. You know, the two leads are Scottish and then Sarah Green is Irish. You know, we're all actors trying to inhabit a world that is not our own, which I do think is part of the craft as well. You know, we have to be given a bit of space to be imaginative and creative in that way.
Absolutely. I mean, as soon as I started watching this series, so I watched the film and was blown away because I was instantly sucked into that world. And having grown up with, I was also living in Bethnal Green for a bit and hearing the kind of East London accent, you know, I lived so close to where the Cray twins used to go to the pub, and I was thinking, oh my gosh, I'm back there. But then in the prequel, I was hoping when something's so beautifully done, you think, oh, please approach it with the same level of energy. And instantly I was taken back to that era. There's a glamour to it, intrigue. It's kind of feels very sex, drugs, brutal crime. And it feels such a far cry from today's society, even though it's set in the 90s? Why do you think we're so obsessed with that era?
Oh my goodness, I'm so thrilled by your energy about this. I think maybe you should just do all my interviews for me, because that's all the sort of stuff that I should be saying about it. So thank you for that. I think they've done a really brilliant amalgam of the music, the visuals, you can kind of smell the petrol of those cars, you know, that it was you can get the smell of it in your nostrils. And the way that their language is inhabited, you know, they're very embodied, which is so brilliantly demonstrated also in the way that they dress themselves and the way that they present themselves. So I just think it's we all have something in us that draws us to a nostalgia. If 10 people were sitting around now just talking about, well, what do you remember from the early 90s, that we would instantly think about the music. We'd think about the food that we were eating, you know, the fact that there were still Wimpies then and you'd pop into Woolworths to nick something. You know, we'd very quickly be drawn into Nostalgia Alley. And because it's not, and this is not a period piece, but it is a look into just a little bit further back from where those characters are in the film to see, well, how did they get there into this world that, like you say, is now so different? And given that it's in the film, it's now in Spain, and London is so different at this, you know, there's a real grubbiness about it, but a lived wellness in the grubbiness, I think is just, it's really tantalizing, and there's something delicious about it, even though it is uncompromising on its depiction of the consequences of violence and the struggle that is required to survive violence.
Do you love playing a baddie?
What is interesting about my age now is that I only seem to be playing baddies at the moment. So it might be to do with the fact that I am this age and people don't quite know what to do with me and my old face. And, you know, my resting face is quite frightening. So maybe people have seen that's a gold mine, that miserable old face. It is quite hard to access that kind of rage, because Cecilia is fueled by rage. The fact that she has saved herself and her younger brother Don, which is the character that Ben Kingsley plays in the film, she has saved them both from an abusive family member in a very violent way. But what she's done is that she's shown to this younger boy, when she was also a child, that she can kill monsters. She can get rid of the monsters, which is really what all parents are seeking to reassure their children about, is that I will stand between you and the monsters. But because Cecilia is so damaged herself, she does it in a really damaged way. So, you know, there is something very distressing about inhabiting that story and accessing that kind of rage. And I did... she comes in like one or two scenes per episode, which I think is probably a good thing, because, you know, like anchovy in a dish, you don't want too much, it overwhelms it. Do you know what I mean? But it's enough to go, hang on a minute, what is that taste? What level of influence is that character wielding over these other supposedly terrifying men? Because she is the top of the pyramid. And how has she got there? I think it's really, you know, I don't think about the idea of playing goodies and baddies. It's a very long answer to your question, a very good question. It's not about, am I playing a goodie or am I playing a baddie? Also, people say, do you prefer comedy or do you prefer drama? I'm not looking at that. I'm looking at what is the truth of this person? What has been their experience? What has have they survived? And I remember someone saying a really great question. The question that people come up with is, well, what is wrong with her? What is wrong with you? And actually, that is the worst possible question to ask. Instead of what is wrong with her, you should be asking what's happened to her. And then you're on a journey of compassion and curiosity and intrigue and potential redemption. And then it's really, really exhilarating.
It would be remiss of me not to ask about The Archers. It's a show that's beloved by thousands. And I feel like if you're part of that community, perhaps even though it is radio, do you get recognised more by Archers fans because they're so committed to the show or telly people?
When people come up to me, they've got that look in their eye they're going to say something, and they go, oh, can I? And I know that they've sort of noticed they want to have a word, and I've got about 1 second to work out what it is they know me from, and I try and guess, and often I'll go, oh, it's The Archers, and often I'm wrong, and they'll say something else. But because I'm now quite known for my visual stuff, people who listened to The Archers way back when now know that I'm the one that plays that, who sort of bobs in and bobs out. It was more away. I'm much more away than I am present, really. But a very interesting thing happened when I was walking the dog one time, and this woman came up to me and was furious that I was not present at the funeral of my character's mother. And the reason was is because I was away filming, and so I couldn't get there. But she was really angry with me, and that was quite a peculiar moment, because I wanted to say to her, I'm really sorry that it meant that much to you. But also I wanted to say to her, it's a radio show. It's a radio show, and I'm an actor, and I was doing something else. Do you know what I mean? It's like that. It's quite a peculiar confusion.
Absolutely, and especially when people feel so strongly about it, and it's one of those programs, you can't help but think, okay, it's not my entire life, just a good job that I did.
Listen, I'm really grateful that job came along when I was so early into my career. I think if I hadn't had that continuity early on, I don't know whether I would have made it, because I'd wonder if I have the stamina to keep going. So I'm so grateful that was there for me, and you know, I'm thrilled that it still has its own wonderful life.
If you enjoyed this episode, you might like to listen to my conversation with Dame Emma Thompson or David Tennant. Both episodes can be found by scrolling back through the Radio Times podcast feed. Thank you for listening to the Radio Times podcast with me, your host, Kellyanne Taylor. If you enjoyed listening to this episode, please do follow, rate and review wherever you get your podcast from. It helps other TV and film lovers find us. Until next Tuesday, happy viewing.